I really appreciate it.
Well, I'm happy to do it. We miss you, but I'm glad you're there on the phone. And let me welcome Judge Gilbert, who is sitting by designation with us today. Judge Keeney and I are both happy to have him here as well.
I know Judge Gilbert very well. We're well served by having him sit with us.
Wonderful. Well, with those pleasantries out of the way, I'll call the first case of this morning, which is United States versus Durham, case numbers 123819, 123833, and 123867. Ms. Jacobs.
May it please the court. There is a common thread running through the three issues that I will address this morning. I will address the wiretap, the securities fraud jury instruction, and the closing argument issues. And it runs also through the two issues that Mr. Muchnick will address, the sufficiency of the evidence and the sentencing issues. And that common thread, I would say, is the fundamental processes and procedures which generally protect a defendant's rights in criminal cases and really demand sort of fairness in criminal cases were somewhat short-circuited here. And I guess what I would say is that the system should demand more. And that's what I'd ask the court to think about as we talk about the different issues that we're presenting here. And I'm going to start this morning on the jury instruction issue because I think it's a pretty good example of the problems that run through this case. The defendant's theory of defense on the securities fraud count 12, was that a scheme to delay, and particularly delay the interest payments on these certificates, is not a scheme to defraud. And that legal notion is, both before and after Merrill Lynch, is well established in securities law. The defendants proffered an instruction on that point, and it was a lengthy instruction, and there's more in the instruction than I want to really talk about this morning. But certainly, they proffered that the scheme to delay interest payments is not in connection with a purchase or sale. In other words, that delay is not would not satisfy the purchase or sale requirement. The court in the jury instruction conference, having been given case law establishing that point, really cut off any discussion of that issue and just said, in the middle of Mr. Tompkins making the record, right, I'm just going to refuse the instruction. She said, just for the record, I'm refusing it because the statute says in connection with. And that's all that was said.
And well, isn't that true? Doesn't the statute just say in connection with?
It does. The statute says in connection with the fraud or the misrepresentations or omissions have to be in connection with, but it says in connection with the purchase or sale. And what I think the defense was getting at was that there was evidence in the record. This isn't a sufficiency challenge. I'm not here to say that there's no evidence also of that the government can point to of fraud in connection with purchase or sale, but there was also evidence in the record of misrepresentations to delay interest payments. And what the defense was asking for, again, was a theory of defense instruction. This court has repeatedly held in all sorts of contexts that if there is some evidence to support a theory of defense instruction, it ought to be given. And that's really where I would say that the process was short-circuited here. This was the core of their defense on this count. And the jury was given no guidance at all other than the language of the statute. And, Judge, I agree, that is the language of the statute. But given that the cases have said that delay, a fraud, or misrepresentation to delay is not enough to satisfy the statute. And I don't know how the jury would ever have grasped that legal notion without some instruction.
Well, the argument was made.
The argument was made, but there was nothing given to the jury to clarify that distinction. I mean, when the jury went back in the jury room, what they had in terms of instruction was in connection with purchase or sale, but no indication of what that means, or that there is a distinction between this delay, you know, fraud to delay, and fraud in connection with the purchase or sale.
As I understand the argument, the defense here, this idea that this was just a scheme to delay rather than a scheme to defraud in connection with the purchase and sale of a security, was the defense spin on the facts, for lack of a better way to put it, as opposed to a legal argument. And the instruction basically calls for a directed verdict in favor of the defense.
Actually, I would disagree,
judgment
Judge.
Of acquittal based on this legal notion that there needs to be a very tight nexus between the fraudulent activity and the purchase or sale of a security.
I respectfully would disagree. And the reason that I say that is I don't think this was just a defense spin. If you look at the government's opening statement, closing argument, and a lot of the evidence, both wiretap evidence, witness evidence, and the like, part of their theory of fraud generally was evidence of delaying interest payments, allegedly telling investors, you know, lies in order to delay having to make those payments. And all I'm saying is there may also be evidence in the record of other fraud, but this isn't a sufficiency challenge. And if all there has to be is some evidence to support the theory of defense, to support the instruction, the theory of defense instruction ought to be given. And as I said before, I mean, I think that this sort of runs through a lot of this sort of short-circuiting of this process. There's no discussion about purchase or sale. We're just going to give them the language of the statute and let the jury figure it out. That runs through a lot of the case here. Another example is the wiretap issue. Because I'd like to get to that. We're splitting our time evenly. I only have 8 minutes here, so I'm going to try to at least touch on the three issues. The wiretap issue, in many respects, I think, is the same. It's not the case law. Well, let me start with the statute. The statute says there has to be this necessity established. And I fully understand this court's case law and courts around the country that say, you know, this isn't a hard burden for the government. They have to connect it to the circumstances of the case, but it doesn't have to be last resort. It doesn't have to be full exhaustion or anything like that. But I would also suggest that the statute has to mean something. The Supreme Court has said in at least a couple of cases there is a restriction here. There is a burden here that the government has to establish over and above just the probable cause.
This was a 45-page application, correct?
I believe so. I can't say that I know 45, but yes.
What more could the government have put in that, in your mind, that would have satisfied the requirement?
Well, what I would say is they put in lots of probable cause, but in terms of the necessity section of the affidavit, they said very little about why the investigative techniques were not sufficient here, why they had to have a wiretap. I would suggest that most of what's in that affidavit, again, it's fact-specific on the probable cause, but in terms of establishing necessity, is what's true in every case. Financial records are complex. They're hard to sort out. Search warrants necessarily mean that the subjects are tipped off. They know there's an investigation. Pen registers don't capture...
That's always going to be the case in large Ponzi schemes. The necessity for the wiretap is going to be the same across all schemes of this sort. You know, the probable cause basis may be fact-specific to what's going on in the case, but the necessity for a wiretap is going to be similar in similar cases.
Maybe, but the case law seems to say that there should be something more than just generic boilerplate, you know, here's what we've done. I mean, if all
Counsel,
it really means is...
When were these instructions tendered to the district judge?
I'm sorry, could you repeat the question,
please?
When
were the instructions tendered to the district judge for his review?
He's going back to the instructions
issue.
The
jury instructions. Judge, I don't recall specifically. I know it was they were not tendered that. I don't think they were tendered that very morning, if that's what you say. And this was an issue that was had been discussed.
Well, when you say that very morning, at the beginning of the trial or at the close of the evidence?
Your Honor, I would like to go back and look at the docket. I don't want to misspeak here. I'm sorry.
Fine.
I apologize. And with that, I'm going to turn over the time to Mr. Muchnick so that he can get to the remaining issues.
That's fine.
Thank you.
Mr. Muchnick.
May it please the Court, Jim Muchnick. I'm here to discuss the sufficiency issue as it relates to counts 2 and 5. My co-counsel, Ms. Jacobs, talked about short circuit issues. This appears to be one of those times where it appears that the government failed to continue to submit the information that they needed in order to tie the specific wires to the specific charges. All we ask here, and I'll be brief, is the court to take a look at the record. What appears here was that the first page of the exhibit that supported counts 2 and 5 was admitted. There was an objection, and the backup pages were not submitted. The government compounded the issue by referencing the backup pages by calling one of the wires for the purposes of building a garage. Ask the court to take a look at the record. There's nothing there that brings those two wires to the specific charges. The government asked this court to sort of gap fill, if you will, by bringing in the in connection with or the in furtherance issue and supposing that anything these defendants touched must be part of the scheme. We would ask the court to look at the record, make sure that before the gap filling begins, that the actual pieces of evidence are present.
Were some of those transfers for legitimate purposes?
Some of the evidence in the record, Your Honor, correct, is for legitimate purposes. The government suggests that anything that's associated with Fair Holdings was for an illegitimate purpose. But there is evidence in the record that the receivables business underlying this overall business conduct of the defendants had legitimate purposes.
Were these funds commingled when they went from Fair to FH1, and could you distinguish between the legitimate and illegitimate purposes?
Well, ultimately, of course, the government has the burden to distinguish between legitimate and illegitimate conduct, particularly if you charge it as a separate offense, that the evidence supporting the wires completes the story. And simply relying on the concept that all of it must have been for an improper purpose, we would suggest falls in the speculation category rather than the specific quantum of evidence that you need in order to show that it was in furtherance of the scheme. So we simply ask that the court review the record and see if this isn't just one of those rare instances where the connect-the-dots job at the conclusion of the trial and making sure that each of the evidence pieces that you submit actually ends up in the record.
Does it make any difference?
We think it does. The difference between the concept of no evidence, which could fall in the concept of speculation, which
no, I mean, does it make any difference to this sentence here if these two individual wire fraud convictions are lopped off?
Ultimately, the determination of the guidelines calculation in connection with the statutory maximum for Mr. Durham would be affected by the court's determination here.
How so? Does it change this from being a life term?
Well, the court can look at the overall guidelines calculation and make the determination that the court could resentence them on the basis of something less than happened. It may not make a substantial difference. Obviously, the difference between a statutory maximum of 220 and 180, but this court's precedent has suggested that.
Does it in fact affect the range? Or does the range still come out at life?
I'm moving quickly to the issue of sentencing, and given the fact that the judge ultimately concluded that the sentencing approach here was based on a combination of factors in the guidelines, we would suggest that it may make a difference. On the issue of sentencing, more importantly, and I'll spend much of my time here that remains, is really continuing this process issue. We'd like to spend a bit more time on the issue of disparity rather than working through the loss calculation issues. On the issue of disparity, before the court was extensive briefing by both parties, the government and the defense, on what else the judge should look at under 35A3-6. And the disparity issue was front and center. The defendants asked the district court to look elsewhere. The government also asked the judge to look elsewhere. The probation officer identified this specific issue. And the district court seemed to agree in the sentencing colloquy that she understood that she needed to address disparity arguments. But when it came down to the exhaustive review that the judge said she would deliver, we would suggest that the court, in fact, said she could not, and in fact did not, address the very issue that both parties asked them to take up, which is out-of-district sentences for comparison purposes. The law here is on our side. 18 U.S.C. 3553 says the court shall consider disparity arguments. The Supreme Court, too, and this court say you must look at both. It is not simply enough to say guidelines, that's good enough. And the precedent here, and certainly at the Supreme Court, says you have to do both, guidelines and disparity.
Well, the guidelines require consideration of substantial arguments made under the 3553A factors, including disparity arguments when they're well-grounded. It doesn't require the court to give them any weight.
But here you couldn't reach that determination, Your Honor, on the record, which is she affirmatively says, I can't.
Well, I read that as I won't in this context when you look at what she said holistically. She said this is the Midwest, and our values are different here. We give greater weight to victim needs here and victim equities and justice. I mean, that's how I view her statement in its totality. Not that I am legally prohibited from considering this factor, which, of course, she knows she's not, but that I just won't give that any weight here because of countervailing values in the holistic sentencing process.
There may be a point with respect to deciding in the totality which side she may have meant. But on the record here, Your Honor, we submit when you affirmatively say she can't, that would suggest that she misunderstood.
But we read the record as a whole and in context, and in context of everything else she was saying about the countervailing weight that she was giving to concerns about justice for the victims.
Well, certainly
that I can't should not be viewed as in the sense that you're suggesting, which is to say that I legally can't consider it. She's saying she's not going to consider it in an exercise of her discretion or give it any weight in an exercise of her discretion, and that's legitimate.
Well, this court has asked the district courts to do more when trying to determine whether or not the judge affirmatively exercised her discretion not to. Ask that the record be read, that it's reviewed, and we suggest you can't put the juxtaposition of I can't with the confidence that the judge exercised
She didn't stop there. She didn't just say, I can't consider it, move on. She said, I can't consider it, and here's why, which makes it clear that she's explaining why she won't consider it in an exercise of her discretion.
We suggest the proper plan, since we're debating the issue, is if you send it back to the district court to clarify that that's, in fact, the plan she had for this sentence. When you walk through five and you skip one and say, I can't, we suggest that means the court should explain further. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Romano.
Thank you. Good morning. May it please the Court, I represent the United States. With the Court's permission, I'll begin by addressing the suppression issue. The District Court did not abuse its discretion in denying the motion to suppress because the government's Title III application adequately explained the need for a wiretap. The wiretap request was not the first step in the government's investigation. For 7.5 months, the FBI had used various traditional measures to investigate the apparent Ponzi scheme being operated at the Fair Finance Company. And in the wire affidavit, the affidavit tied the need for a wiretap to the information that had been learned through those traditional techniques. And I'll just provide one quick example, if I may. The agents knew from analyzing financial records subpoenaed from the Federal Reserve Bank and from looking at open source material that the transactions being directed by Timothy Durham were sophisticated and complex. And so what they needed was information about his intent and his knowledge in directing those transactions, as well as information about other possible participants in the scheme. Further undercover operations would not have yielded that information. Given the scheme's apparent sophistication, it was unlikely that Durham would have exposed an undercover to the details of the scheme within a reasonable amount of time. The FBI had already been using pen registers, and they had looked at a year's worth of telephone records, so they had a sense of who Durham was talking to. What they needed to do was move the investigation forward and find out what was being said. So we submit that the affidavit adequately set forth the need for a wiretap and tied that need to the circumstances of this case.
What about the accounting firms? Had they been part of the investigation? Had they been interviewed?
The accounting firms had not, Your Honor, but it's also important to recall that the accounting firms had been fired, and first was fired in 2005 and the second in 2006. So it's
great source of information.
But it is unlikely that they would have had current information on the conduct that was being going on at Fair Finance. This is 3 years later. And the wiretap also indicated that there was a severe liquidity crisis being experienced at Fair. And again, that was based on investigators' information that they had turned up through these traditional techniques, including interviewing witnesses and talking to the Securities and Exchange Commission, where they learned about an investor complaint that had been filed about the failure to make a timely redemption. And so there's a real danger of using overt investigative techniques. If word got out about the government's investigation, it could have caused a financial panic. Investors might have started a run on Fair as the institution, and it could have caused Fair's collapse. And what the district court concluded was that a wiretap at that point in the investigation provided a practical, common-sense way to move forward. It kept the investigation under wraps while the FBI agents either confirmed that there was fraud going on, or it may have turned out that Fair was simply undercapitalized. But this was a practical, common-sense way to proceed, and we would respectfully argue that the necessity standard was satisfied in this case. Turning to the sufficiency issue, the wire transfers that were charged in counts 2 and 5, the evidence was sufficient that those transfers, which went from the Fair Company to Fair Holdings, were in furtherance of the scheme to defraud.
What evidence was there?
Your Honor, the evidence showed that these were, that the purpose, the evidence allowed the jury reasonably to conclude that the purpose of these transfers was to make purported loans. And as Your Honors know, that was the, sort of the nature of the scheme. These purported loans were at the heart of the scheme to defraud. They were the source of defendants' enrichment, and these are purported loans made with Fair investor money. They were ultimately the cause of Fair's deterioration, and they were the object of defendants' concealment because these purported loans were not disclosed properly.
Is that all that was going on with the holding company during this period of time?
That is what the evidence showed, Your Honor. I know my opponents make the argument at pages 10 to 11 of the reply brief that evidence showed that funds went through Fair Holdings for legitimate purposes. But their citations don't support that argument. They cite three things. The first is an entry in the offering circular that Fair Holdings paid additional compensation to one or two officers. But that doesn't mean that entry doesn't show that the funds originated in a wire transfer from Fair, and it doesn't even show that this additional compensation was monetary. Second, they also cite to separate appendix page 31, and they say that Fair Holdings obtained a loan from an outside lender when it bought Textron.
Saying all these loans were fraudulent?
Our position would be if the evidence showed that the wire transfer was done for the purpose of making a purported loan, then that would be in furtherance of the scheme. And the evidence allowed the jury to conclude that these transfers were purported loan proceeds. Several witnesses testified that the first step in getting loan proceeds to the ultimate recipient was to send the money from Fair to Fair Holdings. And then, for example, if the money were to go on to Durham or Cochran, it would then typically go through DC Investments and then to one of the two defendants. And as to the Count 5 transfer as well, we submitted as evidence there's an email indicating that the $50,000 transfer was requested by Elizabeth McClure, who was Durham's assistant at Obsidian, and she made that request by email to Elaine Hostetler, who was the assistant controller at Fair, and McClure's testimony at pages 527 to 28 of the trial transcript is that typically these loan requests were initiated through this email communication.
Right, and I mean, there's plenty of evidence about how these transactions typically occurred and that Fair was being used as a cash cow for the
right.
holding company to engage in all this illegitimate activity, but without that substantiating section of the exhibits, which were incomplete, apparently, that would have traced the track of these particular transferred funds, we have to basically conclude that every transfer from Fair to the holding company during this time period was for an illegitimate purpose and that the evidence supports that.
Well, I wouldn't go quite so far as to say that, Your Honor. I think the evidence has to, our argument is that the evidence has to show that this was done, that these were purported loan proceeds that were ultimately on their way to a debtor. And we think there is evidence from testimony from three different witnesses that say that the transfer from Fair to Fair Holdings was the first step. That's at page 59 of our brief. So we are not making.
Were any of those transfers for legitimate purposes, though?
I'm sorry.
Were any of those transfers from Fair to Fair Holding for legitimate purposes?
Your Honor, my recall of the evidence.
Are you saying, like Judge Sykes, that all we have to assume that every one of them was for fraudulent purposes?
Well, Your Honor, I think the evidence showed that the transfers were done to send purported loan proceeds to the ultimate recipient, and that these loans were not paid back.
Could you trace those loans? I mean, you say that was the first step. What was the second step and third step
step? I will allow that for these particular transactions, the evidence did not show where the funds went to after Fair Holdings. But our argument is that because the jury could conclude, given the testimony that the transfer from Fair to Fair Holdings was the first step in making these purported loan proceeds, and given the fact that the Count 5 transfer was requested the very same morning it was made, it was requested by McClure to Hostetler, that would be enough for the jury, in the context here, to conclude that these were purported loan proceeds and that they were, therefore, the transfers were in furtherance of the scheme. I know, Judge Sykes, you asked my opponent whether this would have any effect on the sentence. I don't think it would affect the guidelines calculation. I think, Timothy, we're only talking about Mr. Durham here. I think he would still be at an offense level of 47. It would reduce the statutory maximum from, I believe it's 220 to 180, but it would still be an effective guidelines range of life. If the court doesn't have any more questions on this claim, I'll proceed to the jury instruction issue. The district court properly...
Counsel, this is Judge Gate again. I asked that question probably inarticulately, but when were they... Did you tender instructions before the trial started?
Your Honor, upon hearing your question to my opponent, I quickly checked the docket. I did confirm that the government did file its proposed instructions, I believe right around the start of trial. I wasn't able to quickly locate the entry for the filing by Mr. Durham. My sense is that the written request was filed in advance of the jury instruction conference. And what happened is at the jury instruction conference, this relates to our argument that the claim is not preserved, is that the district court settled on its draft of it had, I believe, disseminated a draft of its own proposed instructions, and it resolved issues concerning those. And then at that point, it asked the parties to go through and indicate which instructions it still wanted. So that is what Mr. Durham's attorney was doing at the point where he claims he preserved his claim. What he was actually doing, going through the process of saying, well, in light of the court's instructions that it's decided on, I'm going to tender this instruction, I'm going to withdraw this instruction, and then it's at that point that the court makes the ruling. So our position is that after the court made the ruling, there was no subsequent objection with a specific articulation of the reason for the objection. Nevertheless, we're not hanging our hat here on the standard of review. Even under de novo standard, we don't think the claim prevails because the proffered instruction was not a correct statement of the law. I disagree with Ms. Jacobson's argument. I really do think that the proffered instruction here was asking for a directed verdict on some of these theories that the defense was proffering, because it defined a purchase or sale to require the transfer of ownership of an asset. And then it defined in connection with as requiring that the fraud be directly pertinent to the transaction. So under this instruction, the jury can only find securities fraud if the misrepresentations directly pertained to a transfer of a security. And that wouldn't allow for the jury to consider the evidence showing with respect to the misrepresentations made about delayed interest payments. It wouldn't allow them to conclude, if they found beyond reasonable doubt, that was those misrepresentations were made in connection with the purchase or sale of a security. And the government did present an email, which is at page 209 of our appendix, where it's a very telling email. It's Russell Riggenbach, who's the supervisor of investor relations, is emailing the controller of FAIR as well as Durham, and he's saying, "What I'm hearing from investors is that if FAIR can't make a simple interest payment, why should we invest our money in FAIR? Why should we reinvest our money in FAIR?" So that shows, I mean, defendants knew.
Right. The evidence about the delayed interest payments is certainly relevant evidence to
right.
the scheme. Whether it can support a securities fraud conviction standing alone is a separate question, but it's not standing alone here. We've got all this redemption, you know, that investors made redemption decisions,
exactly.
either to hold them or fold them, basically,
yeah.
Based on this massive fraud, and then new investors made decisions to buy in based on the circulars that were fraudulent and so forth. So it's, you know, it's not the investment or the delayed interest payment standing alone. We've got all of this activity that clearly is in connection with the purchase or sale. So I'm not sure this argument really makes a difference in the context of this case.
I would agree, Your Honor. And we have argued that even if there was some error, and we certainly don't concede there was in denying the request of instruction, there was no prejudice here for precisely those reasons.
The redemption of one of these debentures is clearly the purchase or sale of a security.
Right. It's technically you go and you redeem the old certificate and you buy a new one, and that is a sale and then a purchase. Moving to sentencing issue, my opponent focused on disparity. The district court did not fail to consider the need to avoid unwarranted sentencing disparities. This court's case law, I think, is quite clear that when a district court imposes a within-guideline sentence, it necessarily considers the need to avoid unwarranted sentencing disparities. And the sentences that were imposed here were either below or within the defendant's guideline ranges, depending on whether the sentences received by Durham and Cochran are treated as effective life sentences. But I think in light of the sentences that were imposed, the real question is whether the district court understood that it had authority, if it wanted to impose a lower sentence based on disparity considerations. And we certainly believe that viewing the court statement as a whole, the court didn't misunderstand its authority. It just wasn't going to impose a lower sentence given the...
Was the guidelines range life for each of these defendants or just for Durham and Cochran?
It was life for each. Mr. Snow had an offense level of 45. It's enough to get a 43 offense level to trigger a life range. And Snow was at 45, Cochran at 46, and Durham was at 47.
But their statutory maximum was capped
exactly.
out at, I don't remember out. What, for each of them, but...
But I believe, and I apologize, I don't recall for Mr. Snow, who would have been the lowest, but even for him, it was whatever the aggregation was, it was effectively a life sentence.
What are the life ages guidelines? Of the defendants in this case?
I'm sorry, Judge Kaney.
Are the ages of the defendants in this case?
I believe Mr. Durham and Mr. Cochran are in their 50s. I do not recall Mr. Snow's age. I believe it's within that range as well. But I do think the district court was cognizant of the fact that for some of the sentences imposed on Cochran and Durham, these were long sentences, and certainly as to Durham, it would be an effective life sentence. I think the court made a very thorough record at sentencing of the considerations that it made in coming up with these sentences. I think the court, which had received over 1,000 letters from the victims in this case, I think that victim evidence impacted how it...
Of course, always happens in Ponzi schemes. Everybody wants their money back, right?
That's correct, Your Honor, and there was over $200 million of actual loss here. But I think some of these letters, which the district court summarized experts of, they went beyond just simple demands for letters. These were letters written from the investors, most of whom were retirees, who were hardworking individuals who had saved their money throughout their life so that they would have some security during retirement. And that was taken away by the fraud that occurred in this case. And I think the district court, looking at the egregiousness of the fraud and the devastating impact on the victims, properly concluded that it was not going to give credit to any disparities argument, that it was not warranted in this case, given the nature of the offense and its harm to the victims. Unless the court has any additional questions, we'd ask that the judgments be affirmed in all respects. Thank you.
Thank you. How much time? You've got 2 minutes in rebuttal. I don't know who's taking rebuttal.
Judge Kaney, I think, had it best. These gentlemen were in their 50s. And at least for my client, Mr. Durham, and Mr. Cochran, the court imposed effective life sentences. If the record isn't clear exactly what the court understood her powers to be, should ask that it be sent back for clarification. Saying that it's within the guidelines is enough. In fact, Rita Gall, this court, says it has to be clear. The judge understood the job. Both the prosecutor, both the all the defendants said, look outside Indiana. That's where fraud cases happen to come from these days. Put that in the context of I can't, given the outcome. We ask the court, again, to look carefully and make sure that it's right. Thank you.
Thank you. Our thanks to all counsel. The case is taken under advisement. And Ms. Jacobson, Mr.